Hello, I'm Peter Martin from The Economy Stupid. It's your guide to the world of business, buying and decision making, and what it means for your mortgage, your job, your rent, and what you can afford. Because the economy isn't just out there, it's in here. It's in what we do. Search for The Economy Stupid and hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
The feeling was absolutely palpable of sadness about what these new laws are going to mean for Aboriginal children. Honestly, it was a bittersweet day yesterday.
As Victoria signs a new treaty with First Nations peoples, experts are concerned about the state Labor government's other announcement this week. A new bill called Adult Time for Violent Crime. It could see teenagers sentenced through the adult system, and it's got Indigenous advocates particularly worried. We'll get to that, and also ruptures in the federal Liberal Party as an overwhelming number of members push for it to drop net zero by 2050. We'll hear from one senator hoping that doesn't happen.
We should have a target, and 2050 is our target. It's actually Scott Morrison's target.
And we'll finish with football. Have football bosses squandered the attention the Matildas brought to the women's game during the World Cup? We'll get the view from a veteran player. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thank you for joining The Breakfast Wrap today. There's plenty to get through from Sally Sarah's key interviews on Radio National Breakfast. Before we get to the Liberal Party's discussions on net zero by 2050, there's another story outside of Canberra worth discussing. Adult crime, adult time. That was the slogan the Queensland Liberal National Party took to last year's election and won. So comes as a bit of a surprise to some that that banner has been replicated down south by a Labor government. Premier Jacinda Allen this week announced a similar policy to tackle an increase in youth crime in the state, unveiling a bill called Adult Time for Violent Crime.
There are too many victims and not enough consequences. It's why Victoria will introduce adult time for violent crime, where the courts will treat children for these crimes like adults, where jail will be more likely and sentences will be longer.
So the way this crackdown will work is by moving some of those serious cases from the children's court to the adult county court. The maximum penalty the children's court can hand down is 3 years. So that is, of course, a lot longer in the adult system. The changes mean that teenagers aged 14 and over facing those serious charges could go to jail for life. It's a minimum of 25 years, and it could be a lot more. There are concerns from experts that it could trap young people in the criminal justice system and that it could particularly harm Indigenous teenagers in Victoria who commit serious crimes. Now, as you're about to hear with our next guest, this legislation comes at a time of celebration for many Indigenous people in Victoria. Today, Victoria becomes the first state in the country to formally sign a treaty agreement with First Nations peoples.
We have just witnessed the Premier, the Minister for Treaty and First Peoples, and the co-chairs of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria signed the statewide treaty, the first in Australia and the first for the First Peoples in Victoria.
So there are mixed feelings, as some people celebrate that development, but others in the criminal justice system worry about the laws that are coming. Meena Singh is Victoria's Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People, and she came on with Sally this morning.
How significant is the increase of youth crime in Victoria right now?
There's a lot of talk about youth crime in Victoria, obviously, right now. And what we're seeing is the impact of changes in bail laws that are putting more children and young people into places like Cherry Creek and Parkville. And we have heard that Malmesbury is going to reopen. So we're certainly seeing more and more children getting caught up in the criminal legal system.
And we've also seen an increase in the number of offences as well when it comes to youth crime, particularly things like stealing cars. That's become more of a youth-focused offence.
Yeah, as well as I think things like shop theft and retail theft, those sorts of things as well. So we're really talking about property, kind of debt, property types of offences.
And some of these, when there are home invasions, when people are trying to steal keys for vehicles, some of those are not only property offences, they're violent offences as well.
We're seeing that there's violence being involved, yeah, and people who are victims of those offences are deserving absolutely of all the supports and resources that they need to be able to feel safe again and to be able to recover, because that is such an invasion of their safety and their privacy.
So how do we get the balance right here? Obviously, there are concerns about the welfare of these young people, but also significant concerns about members of the public who are being targeted by these offences.
I mean, you're using the right words, that it's absolutely a balance. You know, what we heard from the government yesterday is that they're listening to victims of these sorts of violent offences, and they absolutely should be listened to. But what we find at the Commission, and what lots of different organisations such as Victoria Legal Aid, such as advocates and people who work directly with children and young people who have offended, who are offending, we need to also listen to what they're saying about the drivers for their offending. And that's where we need to get that balance right. We need to talk and understand what it is that is driving this sort of offending, so that we're not only just addressing the behaviours, but we're also understanding and addressing and providing responses to their needs as well, to prevent this type of behaviour starting in the first place.
To meet those needs, what sort of things are we talking about there?
I mean, they're the things that we've talked about for a long time, and they're really, honestly, very basic things that we start off with. We start off with making sure children and young people, all children and young people, have a safe and stable home environment. So many of the kids that we see at the Commission who have become engaged with the criminal legal system have got backgrounds of trauma, have experienced family violence. We know that there's an overrepresentation in the youth justice system of children who are in out-of-home care or who have had contact with the child protection system. And so that means they've had significant trauma, those things like family violence. They've had perhaps a physical or sexual assault in the home. They've they've lived with neglect and a whole range of other issues. So responding to trauma when it's experienced, but also putting in place the measures that make sure that children are safe at home, also that they're connected with their education.
Victoria's treaty agreement is set to be formally signed today. How significant is that moment, do you think?
It's significant, but sadly, yesterday I was at an Aboriginal Justice Community Forum at the Aboriginal Advancement League, and the feeling in the room, and you know, it brings together government departments and organisations that are part of the Aboriginal Justice Agreement, which was made in which was made some 25 years ago, following the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And you know, there are people in that room that have been involved in Aboriginal justice and lowering overrepresentation of children and young people and adults in the justice system for decades. And the feeling was absolutely palpable of sadness about what these new laws are going to mean for Aboriginal children, because what we see is that when we talk about bringing in specific laws for specific issues, we always see Aboriginal children experiencing poverty, experiencing mental health, disability, a whole range of things. The most vulnerable children in our community are disproportionately picked up. So honestly, it was a bittersweet day yesterday with the signing of treaty and also hearing the announcement of this new policy and laws.
Meena Singh there, the Victorian Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People, talking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast about that youth crime crackdown from the Victorian government, and also that development of the signing of a treaty with the state's First Nations people. So the Liberal Shadow Ministry meets today as it decides on the party's net zero and energy policy position. By the time you're listening to this, an announcement may have been made, but what you're about to hear is the position of a Liberal senator hoping that his party can stay the course and recommit to net zero by 2050. It comes after the Liberals met for almost 5 hours at Parliament House yesterday, And reportedly, the majority of MPs had another view from him, wanting to abandon the party's commitment. South Australian Liberal Senator Andrew McLaughlin joined Sally this morning and she asked him for his take on yesterday's marathon meeting.
How would you describe the discussions yesterday?
Oh, they were excellent. I think it's always good to gather with your colleagues and hear their views. We don't do it enough, I think, and it was a very constructive process.
The Conservatives clearly have support to dump net zero. When did you realise that your view was clearly outnumbered?
I obviously very public that I believe in targets, and I think we should be committed to 2050 for net zero.
What do you think about the cohort who've been keeping their cards close?
Well, each to their own. I can't criticise a colleague. It is a difficult issue in some senses. It's complicated. Even I don't profess to be an energy expert. But I think the public expect us to be committed to the environment, committed to protecting the environment. I consider myself a conservative, and my driving force is to leave the planet in a better place for the next generation. So I would consider myself a conservative, and from that, I believe emission reduction is critically important, as is biodiversity protection, and therefore we should have a target. And 2050 is our target. It's actually Scott Morrison's target. So it's been adopted by Labor, and I think we should commit to it.
How difficult is it going to be for the Liberal Party to win back seats, particularly in city areas, if it drops net zero?
Well, I've campaigned in Boothby and Sturt, so I can speak for that. Very difficult. I think the community want us to show a passion and motivation to leave the world in a better place. And from that, our policy should unfold. And I think if you can't show that motivation or that integrity of thought, it's a major factor in how they cast their vote.
If the Liberal Party can't win those city seats, can you then therefore not win government again?
Well, that's mathematics, so I have to agree with you. I think you should be appealing to all Australians no matter where they live.
So is it likely that the Liberal Party and the Coalition more widely can return to government if it doesn't have net zero, if it doesn't win those city seats?
Well, I wouldn't be supporting if I thought something different. I think it's incredibly important to have a policy suite that's received by the community. And Susan Lee has said that she wants to meet the community where they are. I don't think you should have ideological battles over numbers. I think we should be on a journey to demonstrate that we are the best transition managers to get to net zero. We have a disposition towards private enterprise, which we think should be able to achieve it faster. Labor might be on a disposition of more government intervention. I would like the debate to be about how much money we spend, where we spend it, and how effective it is, and how we can unleash the talents of Australians to get us to a better place with our emissions and protecting our natural world.
Could it be electoral disaster for the Liberal Party if you scrap net zero?
I'll leave it to the pundits and the commentators. I wouldn't be advocating for net zero if I didn't think it was important, but I don't see how you can go to the electorate and say, well, we've committed to net zero 2050 since Scott Morrison days, and now we think it's a bad idea.
So the destination should be the same. The argument should be about the best way to get there. Is that what
Yes.
you mean? Opposition leader Susan Lee, is she now in a position where she'll need to dump net zero?
I don't know. I can't speak for her. Susan Lee, I'm a big supporter of Susan Lee's, and I voted for her. And I think she's done a fantastic job post a difficult election loss. It's not the easiest job in the world, I think it's said so many times in this place in Canberra. This was for her to take the temperature of the room, to understand the arguments, and she and her leadership team will come to a conclusion. I don't want to preempt that.
What do you say to your colleagues who believe that scrapping net zero will be electorally advantageous?
You're wrong. What more can I say? I try to argue the case. I don't think I'm alone in the community, not only from a grassroots level, but also, for example, the National Farmers Federation, certain business councils. I mean, if you're going to argue that we're going to abandon net zero, you're going to be very alone in the community and also the business community. I think all levels of community have moved on.
Does it make it hard for you to stay in the party?
I've been in the Liberal Party a long time. I can never imagine not being in the Liberal Party. It may get hard at times, but I'm committed.
Do you think there can be an accommodation that staying in the Paris Agreement is a de facto net zero pledge anyway, if that's put to the public? Look, we're not going to go to net zero, but we'll stay with Paris.
I don't think you can, because Paris is about net zero. It uses slightly different language, but it's about how much carbon you produce and then abating it. I mean, we have too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It is creating a blanket around the planet, and it's heating. I mean, I see the only debate is how you address it.
Just finally, including the issue of emissions, but speaking more broadly as well, the future success of the Liberal Party, does that involve seeking votes in the middle, if you like, or does it involve shifting further to the right?
Well, I don't think you should be shifting. I think it's a difficult concept, shifting to the left and the right. What does that mean? We're in a very difficult world. If you asked me that question in the 1950s, I might more easily be able to answer that. My view is you have to build coalitions and engagement with as many people to get you over the requisite number of votes. If you wish a very, very pure line, well, then you can be like One Nation or you can be like the Greens, but then you're capped. We should always be aspiring to be a party of government.
Would Andrew Hastie be a good leader of your party?
I think every person in the party room has potential to be leader of my party room, but we senators are excluded.
South Australian Liberal Senator Andrew McLaughlin there. And you can keep across all the developments, of course, on ABC platforms today, but also tomorrow morning on Radio National Breakfast. We will have the very latest for you from 5:30 a.m. on Radio National and also the ABC Listen app, and then later on in the day, right here on The Breakfast Wrap. Well, let's turn to some foreign policy. And Australia and Indonesia have agreed to a historic bilateral security treaty.
It signals a new era in the Australia-Indonesia relationship. The treaty is predominantly based on the landmark security agreement signed by the Keating and Suharto governments 30 years ago.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese there. This treaty will require both countries to consult on security on a regular basis and consider taking joint action if either nation is under threat. But a lot of the detail is still yet to be made public. The Lowy Institute's Sam Roggeveen told Sally just what we know about this deal so far.
The operative parts of it, though, are, as you just heard the Prime Minister describe it, it's an attempt to go back to the 1995 treaty. The symbolism of 1995 is rich. The fact that this is a callback to Keating and Suharto is significant, in the sense that Keating at the time said that, at least in stature, if not in substance, that the then new treaty would be on the same level as ANZUS, as Australia's relationship with the United States. So if that is the kind of feeling, the kind of stature and status that that this Australian government is trying to create in its relationship with Indonesia, then to my mind, that's altogether welcome.
So in the real world, how does all of this work, particularly given Indonesia's tradition of non-alignment?
Yeah, and we have to maintain a sort of healthy sense of realism here, because the Indonesians under Prabowo have also indicated that they're willing to move closer to other partners, including China and Russia. But I think we can be quietly pleased in Australia that this is a significant diplomatic victory. We share the same strategic geography, and we have one, I think, key security interests in common, which is that neither country wants to see maritime Southeast Asia dominated by a foreign power. And of course, you know, we can easily read China into that.
When you look at this agreement, which was announced yesterday, how do you think we then characterise the current state of the relationship between Australia and Indonesia? Because it's had troubled times in the past.
It's had troubled times and it can be volatile. So at official level, it's never been better. And this treaty really reinforces that sense. And Australia's biggest embassy in the world is in Jakarta, which is itself, I think, indicative of the weight that we place on it. The problem is that we've never been able to really solidify it beneath that official level. So the economic relationship is rather anemic, despite the fact that we have a free trade agreement with Indonesia. And people-to-people links are also pretty thin. I mean, there's barely an Indonesian diaspora in Australia. It's very, very small. That is, I think, an important bit of ballast in the relationship that needs to be worked on, increasing the economic relationship and the people-to-people links.
Lowy Institute's Sam Roggeveen there, explaining the significance of this treaty that Australia is set to sign with Indonesia.
Courtney Vine at her first World Cup.
And that penalty kick took Australia's Matildas to the FIFA World Cup semi-finals on Australian soil. That moment a couple of years ago, bringing the nation together and bringing unprecedented attention to the Women's World Game. But a new report into the domestic league warns the sport may have squandered that attention. Crowds are in decline and players are among the lowest earning female athletes in the country. Tamika Yallop is a Brisbane Roar midfielder in the A-League. She's played in four World Cups for the Matildas, and she's also the co-president of the Professional Footballers Association. She came on and she gave Sally a sense of just how female footballers are feeling right now playing in Australia.
As a player that's been in the league for a long time, it's quite disheartening to see, I guess, how stagnant the league has kind of become in terms of wages, especially with, you know, the increases in costs and also the competitiveness that we have with many other sporting codes, especially in the women's game. So, for me to see, I think it's disheartening, especially after the massive impact we had with the Women's World Cup. I would have certainly liked to have seen this aspect increase.
This report also shows that more than 6 in 10 of the female football players in the domestic league say they work other jobs outside of football. Do you think that's widely understood?
Not exactly. I think that can kind of be missed sort of by the outside world. And I think we have really promoted the fact that we have sort of grown in certain aspects of the league going to an actual full home and away season. However, we're not actually contracted for 12 months of the year. We're only contracted for 8. So we are kind of performing full-time jobs, but still not actually on full-time contracts.
Tamika, is it becoming even more difficult to keep quality players in Australia when they can make a lot more money overseas, especially in Europe?
Yeah, it is. And I think we have a lot of talent coming up through in Australia and they do go overseas because there is more competitive wages, but also full-time programs. And, you know, lots of players do have dreams of playing in the national team and sort of to make it to that level, you do actually have to be in a full-time program and working sort of round the clock to make that happen. So we are losing a lot of players overseas and perhaps not attracting enough either because there isn't that full-time program.
What needs to be done, Tamika? What do you think are the changes that need to be put in place here?
Yeah, I think we need to see an investment in the wage growth and raising the minimum that we do have in the league. And there's so much potential to bring in a lot of that revenue just by making that adjustment to the minimum wage and to full-time contracts where we can actually tap into the rest of the transfer market that is kind of exploding around the world.
Some really strong recommendations to those concerns highlighted in this report and by the co-president of the Professional Footballers Association, Tamika Yallop, a Matilda, who's played in four World Cups for Australia. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Lexi Junawick. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll be back same time, same place tomorrow. And of course, you can listen to Radio National Breakfast live on the wireless, 5:30 a.m. every morning.